Hi, my name is Mandy Jackson Beverly, and I'm a bibliophile. Welcome to the Bookshop Podcast. Each week, I present interviews with independent bookshop owners from around the globe, authors, and specialists in subjects dear to my heart, the environment and social justice. To help the show reach more people, please share it with friends and family and on social media. And remember to subscribe and leave a review wherever you listen to this podcast. You're listening to episode 209. Jenny Shear is a National Book Foundation 5 Under 35 honoree whose debut novel, Holding Pattern, was released in June 2023 by Riverhead Books. Her short fiction has appeared in AGNI, Ninth Letter, Joyland, Android Journal, Narrative, The Offing, and The Best of the Net anthology, among other publications. Her writing on design, travel, and culture has been featured in The Atlantic, The Washington Post, Architectural Digest, Apartment Therapy, Them, and Dwell, where she was previously the executive editor. Jenny holds degrees from UC Berkeley and Johns Hopkins University and is the grateful recipient of fellowships from Breadloaf, McDowell, Yaddo, Kundiman, Aspen Words, the Virginia Center for the Creative Arts, Loghaven, and other organizations. Born in Shanghai and hailing from California, Jenny is currently based in Brooklyn, New York. Hi, Jenny, and welcome to the show. It's great to have you here.
It's so good to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
My absolute pleasure. Now let's begin with learning about you, your time at UC Berkeley and Johns Hopkins University, writing for magazines, and what drew you to writing fiction.
I would say writing fiction probably is the first thing that's happened in my life. All of those kind of life moments. I was always really fascinated with storytelling and just the concept that you could reach someone through time and space with words was, really wild to me off the bat. So that was, I was writing quote unquote novels in third grade and stapling them together and passing them out. So that was always a through line. And then I studied, writing English and creative writing at UC Berkeley. I had the privilege of studying under really amazing writers there and joining workshops there. And also lived in a co-op there, which is what is loosely what the co-op is in Holding Pattern is based off of. It was 126 18 to 22 year olds governing themselves with no adult supervision. So you can imagine it was really wild, but it was very formative. And then after that, I thought I was going to do a PhD in English literature. And I took one honor seminar and realized I don't want to be chewing over theory day in and day out. I really wanted to be in the lived craft of it. So I decided then to get my MFA and ended up going to Hopkins in Baltimore. And coming out of the MFA, and that's when I had started sort of writing the beginnings of Holding Pattern, although I didn't know it was going to be a novel then. Was sort of floundering about what to do. And I ended up working at Dwell Magazine, which is a design publication based in the Bay in New York. And I started, as a branded content writer and then worked into the editorial side and became executive editor. And that's where I was for 5 or 6 years until about a year ago.
I like Dwell Magazine, especially the articles about environmental design. Now, you were talking about the co-op. Was that through UC Berkeley? How did you find out about it?
So I was the recruitment coordinator too for the co-op system. So I remember some of the spiel I would give to students as I was luring them in. But Berkeley Student Cooperative is the largest student housing cooperative in North America. So there are 17 houses and they range in occupancy from 10 people to 156 people. And I lived in the two biggest ones. That was Cloyne, which was a converted hotel, and CZ, which was built in the 60s or 70s. I have to check on that. But it was the first one built to be a student housing cooperative. So it's sort of this four-story sprawling brutalist structure. And it has these wings because men and women used to be divided. And it's funny, the women's wing was all straight, so you could see down the hallway and see if they had overnight guests, but the men's wing was curled around, so they had more privacy. But yeah, it's just a lot of lore. And yeah, it's sort of just through word of mouth. There's, you know, the Greek system, and then there's the co-op system, which, you know, had the reputation for being, you know, very experimental and lenient and sort of like freewheeling. And a lot of kids were, you know, excited about that.
Yes, I can imagine they were. They must have loved that freedom.
Oh my gosh. It was lawless.
Okay, let's talk about Holding Patton, your new book. Can you give our listeners a short synopsis of the story, please?
Yeah. So Holding Patton is the story of a woman named Kathleen Chang, and she's in her late 20s and her life has sort of fallen apart at the seams. She is going through a really terrible breakup. She is dropping out of her PhD program. She's moving back home to see her mom, Marissa, in Oakland, where she grew up. And instead of seeing the mother that she remembers, who was really struggling with the dissolution of her own marriage and drinking and finances, the Marissa that Kathleen now encounters is, you know, 2.0. She's drinking green juice and rock climbing, and she's engaged to this tech entrepreneur. And Kathleen finds herself, you know, being the maid of honor to her mom when she thought she was going to be the one getting married. And they sort of fight through all the tensions of their relationship as they prepare for this wedding. And at the same time, Kathleen starts, you know, taking up a gig as a professional cuddler. And that opens up a portal for her to understand connection and intimacy in a way that helps her in all of her relationships, but especially with her mom.
Thank you. That was a really good synopsis. Now, how much of Kathleen is biographical?
Kathleen is biographical to the point where I feel like all of my writing is biographical and not biographical. And I mean that in the sense of, for me, I feel like I can't write too far beyond what I'm empathetically able to imagine. It's almost like if a visual artist has colors on their palette, like the experience of my life and the emotional beats of my life are those colors on my palette. And if I can't somehow connect to it, then I can't write about it. So while like none of the one-to-one details of Kathleen and Marissa's lives have happened to me, elements of them and echoes of them have happened. And so they're sort of like a remix of all the things that have been the stuff of my life. So growing up in an immigrant family, being an only child, dealing with the sort of distance in family, which is what happens when you're in an immigrant family and moving to a whole new world, and you sort of like lose the cultural touch points and shared history and just shared worldviews that can happen when, you know, generation by generation, you live in completely opposite ends of culture. Yeah, so a lot of that I was playing with, living in the Bay also, and, you know, seeing tech sort of like come over it like a tidal wave.
Yeah, I understand, because I'm also an immigrant. And even though I came from Australia to England to the United States, all English-speaking countries, the cultures were different. The way people speak and the way they do things is different. And it takes time to understand this process. I arrived in the early 80s, and the American dream was a reality. But the American dream also comes with undertones that can be disappointing, frustrating, and a little scary. And one of those is the culture of guns. And I don't think I'm ever going to get used to it. Never, ever.
It's terrifying. It's so frustrating to be the only country that, you know, lives with it in this way. And we're all like, how could this be happening? Yes, terrifying.
Yes, it is. Now, connection, intimacy, and authenticity are words you've used when relating to touch. In a recent essay for Esquire magazine, you wrote about your experience as a cuddler. Quote, "What I offer as a personal cuddler is platonic touch, but what platonic means starts to smear when you're curled up with a stranger in a hotel bed." And you continued, "What I learned in my research is that while professional cuddling is far from mainstream, the need it can answer is monumental. The Surgeon General calls America's suffering an epidemic of loneliness. You also went on to say, I wanted to examine the fine gossamer boundary between sex and intimacy, pleasure and caretaking. Now, unlike Kathleen, the character in your book, whose cuddling occurred in a specific workplace, your cuddling took place in non-specific areas. What did you learn about boundaries, and were you ever scared? And did you have a getaway plan?
I'll answer the last question first and say I'm ashamed to say I didn't have a get out of there quick plan, but I did make sure that a couple people knew where I was going to be. And if I didn't check in afterward, after a certain time frame, they would sort of ring the alarm. So there was that in place. I'm so sorry. Now that I've answered that question, what were the first two?
Well, what did you learn about boundaries, and were you ever scared?
Oh, yes. Oh, my gosh. Yeah. So, I mean, I used a site called cuddlecomfort.com, which is very different from the Midas Touch cuddle clinic that I invented. It's maybe one step above Craigslist in terms of sketchiness. And I had to do a lot of my own legwork in terms of, you know, sussing out if this is someone that I can trust to be safe with in this space. And I learned, I mean, this sounds simple, but just the importance of setting up boundaries. And I thought I was the type of person who was very good at setting up boundaries, but it turns out that it's so easy to have something in your mind and so much harder to enact that in the actual session itself, because so much is at play, right? There's the weirdness of this being a commodified transaction. And so I felt, you know, pressure to provide a service in, you know, a people-pleasing way. There's the danger aspect, as you mentioned, of will this person physically harm me? There's, you know, the gumminess and murkiness of consent when the work itself is intimacy and you do want to derive pleasure from it, right? So much about skin contact and touch is that release of oxytocin and that lowering of stress and that lowering of blood pressure. And absolutely, pleasure is bound up in that. And the difference between sexual pleasure and platonic pleasure, is it actually as cut and dry as you would think? And I don't think they should be, but we want it to be, right? Because we want it to be clear and easy to navigate, but it just isn't that way. And so I found I had to really work to set up a framework where we knew, both of us knew what was happening. And that meant setting up a space where we practice saying no to specific kinds of touch, just so you have that in your language and it doesn't feel like such a negation or denial if someone's like, that's not comfortable with me. So just practicing saying no is important. Just reiterating, being very verbal about like, these are areas not to touch, checking in, making sure like, are you comfortable? Am I comfortable? Being verbal about it, being clear about it. And I found that that made me feel safer. Those were the times where I felt like the boundaries were working, and the boundaries around like what's actually happening mentally is harder to parse. But I found that if I felt safe, that was okay. That it was okay to sit in this situation where it's like, I feel pleasure. And is that comfort? Is that something else? Do they feel comfort? Do they feel something else? That's always going to be like an ongoing thing to untangle, I think. I've never felt actually in danger. I think the one time that I was like, oh, maybe I shouldn't have done that, is a client brought over empanadas that he'd made, which was so sweet. And I took a bite of it. And then I was in my own home and, you know, had this thought of like, oh no, what if they were drugged? And that was so stupid. So, you know, I would be more careful about things like that. But also on the flip side, you know, I think about going on dates and, you know, how much we trust this person also in, you know, in those situations where you are kind of just as vulnerable. So all of which is to say, I think being a femme body in this world is dangerous.
And I'm guessing it's all subjective. Every different cuddling session is different depending on the personality of your client. And it's all thought of for writing, right?
Everything in my life, good or bad, at least I have like, at least now that's material.
Yes, absolutely. And that's why writers carry notebooks everywhere. Now, getting back to the book, after a breakup, Kathleen moves from Baltimore back to her mother's home in Oakland. However, when she arrives home, the version of her mother is not the woman she was expecting. Marissa, Kathleen's mother, struggled with alcoholism during Kathleen's childhood. And Marissa's transformation is shocking to Kathleen and slightly annoying. She's arrived home unsure what to do about the PhD program in cognitive psychology she's studying. She's sad and depressed about her breakup with Oren, her boyfriend, and wants to wallow in self-pity, not something Marissa is willing to let her do. When writing the story, did you ever visualize other scenarios of how Kathleen would find Marissa upon her arrival home?
That's such an interesting question. It's such a deep craft question too, because I think what that is it's untangling what friction would be. And, you know, it really goes into the root of, okay, what is it that these characters want from each other? And their history being that Kathleen was always the caretaker for her mom as she was sort of floundering and really feeling like sort of put upon, like, why did I have this responsibility? Why did I have to be the mother? And now when I am hurt and I'm come home and I want the chance to sort of wallow in misery, you're out gallivanting about. And I love that you picked up on this, like, annoyingness too, of like your veneer of health and like Silicon Valley wellness and optimization. And it's just another slap in the face for Kathleen. And so I don't know if it's almost like a chicken or egg thing. I think both of those needs in terms of like the plot and character, which is that there needed to be a homecoming and I wanted there to be a reckoning of some sort to sort of untangle, you know, what is the tension of a mother and daughter? What do they owe each other? What happens when they're so culturally different? I knew those things I wanted to wrestle with. So in a way, I had no idea what Kathleen would find when Marissa came back home, but also I think what I landed on felt inevitable because it was just all these themes at work and I just had to figure out how to put it together.
And when you were writing the book, did it all flow naturally or did you need to pre-plan each chapter in advance?
Oh my gosh, Mandy, I wish. No, it was so excruciating and I really hope that book two is not like this. Actually, book two is not like this. I've started writing a new manuscript, but no, it was almost like driving, you know, with the headlights off. I just had no idea what was ahead of me. And I think that came from, you know, not having worked on something of this length before. I'd only written short stories and I didn't know where I was going, but I also really liked that I gave myself that chance to explore. Because it really was sort of like a domino effect of like, once I hit on one thing that felt right, something like, oh, Kathleen is going to be a cuddler. Then it just sort of like, okay, what's the next step? Okay, well, what's the business look like that does that? And, oh, how does that tie into like the Silicon Valley backdrop? And, oh, who might she meet there? And so it's sort of like, once you start setting up these things in motion, it's almost like wind up dolls. You kind of just let them go and see what collides. And, you know, earlier drafts of this were very messy. I put too much in there. And, you know, later drafts were about like, okay, what are the main things? What is interesting? What is connecting? And I can sort of just like separate out the stuff that didn't need to be there.
I think that's the fun part. You know, writing and editing, it's so much fun.
It's so fun in retrospect. In the moment, it's torture.
Yes, that's true. There are days when you think, oh my God, what am I doing? I'd like to move on to creativity. And I'd love it if you could expand on the negative space regarding human connectedness and the negative space regarding relationships and the moments of waiting with social media. And what I mean by that is, oh, who's going to like this? Who's going to comment on this? The reason I'm interested in this question is because I'm an artist and I tend to look at the negative spaces rather than the positive spaces. And for our listeners, what that means is the blank spaces that are created around the main focus of a painting. And I think this relates to writing as well. So I'd love your thoughts on this.
I love that. I also come from a visual art background. So I think a lot about negative space. And, your question reminds me of a line in the book where Kathleen is thinking about her ex, Oren, and she's thinking about, you know, lying in bed and the negative space between them. And it was support, it's, you know, was telling her something that she wasn't admitting at the time. But I really feel that negative space is important in relationships, and especially intimate relationships, because you have this narrative that you're so close and you know everything about each other, whether it be, you know, a mother-daughter relationship or a long-term romantic partner or a best friend. But I've found in my experience over and over that actually maybe the people you're closest to are actually just the people you're able to see that distance more clearly with, if that makes sense. Like with, you know, someone you know a little bit more surface level, I think you can look at them and say, okay, I know this about them and I don't know this about them. And then with someone you're really close to, you think, oh, I know everything about them. And then you look closer and you're like, oh, I know nothing about them. You start to see how maybe you thought like proximity was intimacy, or you fall into patterns, or you just form narratives about this person because you've been with them for so long. And that can be beguiling. And actually, there are moments where they surprise you and you realize like, no, this is a living, growing human being who's struggling with self-identity just as much as I am. And if they are constantly growing and I am too, how can we know each other perfectly? That's impossible. And so I think with close people, you see that more often.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you. Often when couples have been together for, you know, decades, what used to annoy one about the other and vice versa, years later doesn't seem as irritating. Sometimes it can get worse too. But I think maybe as you get older, it's more of a simpatico relationship. And maybe that's because with age comes a little bit of wisdom, one hopes, and some patience. Okay, let's get back to the book. How did the character Phil fall into the story? And were you aware of the slowness of his cuddling juxtaposed with his quick pursuit of Kathleen while you were writing the first draft?
I always knew that I wanted something a little off kilter to come out of Kathleen's foray into cuddling and Midas touch. And I think I knew pretty early on that that was going to be a client and the muddy relationships that you might develop with a client in that environment, because how could you not? But I did struggle with, you know, what are the contours of that and what is the intent behind that? Phil is, I think, really, really well-intentioned and in some ways a little delusioned, but, you know, in some ways one of the most forthcoming and honest and vulnerable men in the book. And I did want to sort of portray his, you know, this slow steadiness in the way that he's entering this cuddling thing, because it's new for him too, but a sort of like pointedness in the way of how he wants to shape these sessions he's holding with Kathleen and what he wants out of them. And I wanted that to be an expression of, you know, this is what happens when people are hurt, and doing things that might feel good, but not interrogating them fully. And I feel like that's very human. And I wanted actually all the characters in the book to sort of land that way, in the sense of, okay, that's a bad decision, but I see why they might pursue it.
And in the Chinese culture, the rat represents wisdom, wealth, and prosperity. And without giving too much of the story away, did you think about this while you were writing?
No, I'm sad to say it didn't. But, you know, in retrospect, I did try to think about, wait, you know, I was thinking of titles too, because Holding Pattern wasn't always the title. And at one point I was like, what if I called it Year of the Rat? Just because I like the way it sounded. And I was like, maybe it has some sort of like thematic ties into the book. That didn't end up working out. But I mean, I do love the rat as a symbol. Like, I love that wealth and prosperity, because usually, I mean, in like this culture, in American culture, it's so, you know, it's a symbol of the sewer. But I do love that it's sort of like this like underdog or like flip of what you normally think a rat would be. The reason for the rat is, when I lived in the co-ops, we weren't allowed to have pets. We weren't allowed to have warm-blooded pets, but rats were small enough to hide. So actually a lot of people in the house had pet rats.
That makes perfect sense. What genre of books do you enjoy reading?
Yeah, I read, I like to say, I like to think that I read pretty widely, but I'm very much rooted in literary fiction and contemporary fiction. I'm trying to read more poetry and read more memoir and nonfiction in general. But right now I'm reading Gina Chung's Sea Change, which is a delightful book. It came out recently also about a woman who's also kind of grappling with love, and she works in an aquarium, and the other main characters is this giant Pacific octopus. And I just finished Diquette by Jenny Fran Davis, which is so fun. It's about, you know, three lesbian couples that kind of vacation upstate in New York. And it just, you know, it's delicious. It's so funny and very smart.
And just so people don't get confused, you have the same name as the poet, Jenny Shear. So can you give people your website information, please?
Sure. It's Jenny Shear Writes.
And that is JennyXie Writes.
Yes, there's a poet also named Jenny Shear who's incredible, but we are two different people, as confusing as it is.
Okay, now I have a personal question to ask you. You were in Books Are Magic a couple of weeks ago, and you had this incredible green and white dress on. Where did you get that dress, please? And who was the designer?
Thank you. Thank you so much. I bought it secondhand through Poshmark, but the designer is, it's Mara Hoffman.
Well, you looked fantastic in the dress, and it had a beautiful flow. The colors were divine. You just look so happy and vibrant in that dress.
Oh my gosh, thank you, Mandy. The one good thing, I mean, not one good thing, one of the many good things that have been coming out of this book stuff is I get to buy dresses to wear at events.
Yes, I think if you look good, you feel good. You know, if something feels really comfortable, it just makes such a difference. I love antique and thrift store shopping and looking for, you know, great designers online too. I think it's good for us and good for the planet. So I'm all for that. I was a costume designer, stylist for many years, and gosh, I can't tell you how many thrift shops I have been into in my life worldwide. When I see someone in a great looking outfit, I want to let them know and give them a compliment. So you looked fabulous in that green and white dress.
Oh my gosh, thank you for saying that.
Jenny, thanks for being a guest on the Bookshop Podcast, and I wish you all the best with your new novel, Holding Pattern.
Thank you so much. I love this conversation.
You've been listening to my conversation with Jenny Shear about her new novel, Holding Pattern. To find out more about the Bookshop Podcast, go to thebookshoppodcast.com and make sure to subscribe and leave a review wherever you listen to the show. You can also follow me at Mandy Jackson Beverly and the Bookshop Podcast on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook, and on YouTube at the Bookshop Podcast. If you have a favorite indie bookshop that you'd like to suggest we have on the podcast, I'd love to hear from you via the contact form at thebookshoppodcast.com. The Bookshop Podcast is written and produced by me, Mandy Jackson Beverly. Theme music provided by Brian Beverly. Executive assistant to Mandy, Adrian Otterhahn, and graphic design by Francis Farala. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next time.